Chapter 4. Coming of Age. Just out of its teens, the computer is beginning to affect the very fabric of society, kindling both wonder and widespread apprehension, Time magazine proclaimed in an April 1965 cover story entitled The Cybernated Generation. The world beyond the confines of spying was beginning to wake up to what this new arrival might mean. The article described how, in air-conditioned rooms, the machines were lined up in rows, waited upon by crisp, white-shirted men who move softly among them like priests serving in a shrine. In 1951, the magazine reckoned there had been fewer than 100 computers in the U.S., but 14 years later, there were now 22,500, four times as many as existed in the rest of the world put together. The machines were performing tasks from navigating planes, sorting out taxes, to mixing cakes. The computer industry was reckoned to provide 650,000 jobs on $5 billion of sales. Yes, jobs were being lost by automation, but an IBM economist assured everyone that soon the process would bring about a 20-hour week and a mass leisure class. In Chicago, a drive-in computer center was offering to process information for customers while they waited. The New York Stock Exchange had built a talking computer that could provide information over the phone. The day is clearly coming when most computers will be able to talk back, Time predicted. American Airlines ran the single most expensive system, at least as far as the public knew. Its genesis came when a young IBM salesman sat next to the president of the airline on a 1953 flight. That chance meeting led within a decade to the $30 million Sabre semi-automated business environment system, in which a computer in New York processed 84,000 requests a day that came over phone lines to tell travel agents what seats were available on flights. But Time also asked a question: is the computer a friend or enemy of man? The reliance on machines was already apparent. If all the computers went on the blink, the country would be practically paralyzed, it wrote. Plants would shut down, finances would be thrown into chaos, most telephones would go dead, and the skies would be left virtually defenseless against enemy attack. And so, hot on the heels of the computer age had come the realization that the seductive power of computers brought with it dependence. All the 21st century talk of cyber security is far from new. It is merely the modern reworking of much older fears over the vulnerability of computers, vulnerabilities that spies would come to exploit. But in the 1960s, it was the U.S. Air Force that was at the leading edge of understanding those dangers. Bletchley was not the only destination for those first visiting American codebreakers in the Second World War. They were also taken to Dover Castle, which overlooked the channel that separated Britain from occupied Europe. The Americans had already been to the RAF station at Cheadle and seen how Britain used traffic analysis and direction finding to scramble its fighters in as fast as 10 minutes from the time a message was intercepted, indicating that the German bombers were on their way over the water. But at Dover, the Americans were shown how another new invention, radar, worked. Prescott Currier could remember two things about his Dover visit. Firstly, the prettiness of the female operators who sat at screens monitoring the radar signals. And secondly, the way one of them had tapped him on the shoulder. "In about 3 minutes, go outside and look up," she said. Standing on the famous White Cliffs, he saw a squadron of German bombers approaching right on cue, but coming the other way, alerted by radar, were British Spitfires. They came together in the skies above the cliffs and intermingled, making it hard for a moment to tell who was who before the Germans were forced to retreat. That was what radar could do. Brave pilots and superbly engineered planes counted for a lot, but so did information and data flow to make sure the planes and pilots could get where they needed to be. In the Cold War, the importance of this technology, including interconnected computers, would only grow. The 1950s and early 1960s were years when the Cold War was at one of its most dangerous points, with annihilation only a few moments away. The fear was of Soviet planes dropping nuclear bombs on America. Anyone who thought about it for a moment understood that the drills for people to hide behind a desk or a door when the alarm sounded would be little hope against an atomic blast that could flatten a city in an instant, spilling radiation across the well-groomed gardens of the suburbs. America's own nuclear-armed bombers would constantly circle the Arctic, ready to head to the Soviet Union to drop their own bombs in retaliation. But could anything be done to stop the Soviet planes getting through? The only defense was fighter aircraft and missiles. Early warning and radar, as witnessed at Dover Castle, were vital. Electronics had been developed for radar in the war, and computers like ENIAC for ballistic artillery calculation, and now the hope was to merge the two by having computers help perform the complex task of finding targets as they approached. America began building a vast array of radars spread as far afield as possible to alert it to incoming Soviet bombs, so it could get its own planes or missiles up as quickly or automatic as possible. These radars were initially in the continental U.S., but spread further afield out to the remote northern tip of Greenland and also to North Yorkshire in Britain, where strange golf-ball-shaped structures appeared on the moors at Fylingdales in the early 1960s. Britain, too, was developing its own computer-controlled fighter intercept system in the 1950s, and a declassified report explains the vital role machines could play in meeting the challenge of a massive attack. When an air attack develops at a rapid rate and the fighter defense has little control capacity or warning in hand, the task of allocating the right fighters to the right targets at the right time is beyond the capability of the unaided human brain. On the other hand, certain rather subtle considerations based on intelligence reports, identification problems, psychological factors, and on a broad appreciation of the tactical position ought to enter into the decision, and these considerations cannot readily be built into a simple electronic computer. Man and machine would need to be melded. A computer, it was hoped, could draw in all the information and help a person make a speedy decision. American Airlines Sabre was an outgrowth of America's vast air defense system called SAGE, Semi-Automatic Ground Environment, built to do just this. First conceived of in 1951, SAGE would take a decade to bring online, but then survive all the way through until 1983. It cost $8 to $12 billion, not in current money, but in 1950s prices, making it more expensive than the Manhattan Project. IBM threw everything at making sure it got the contract, which generated 80% of the company's revenue from computers in the mid-1950s. It was the largest, most expensive, and ambitious computer system ever built. The first geographically distributed, online, real-time application of digital computers in the world, IBM would boast. It was also a creature of its time, when nuclear oblivion was only a moment away. The control center for SAGE, weighing in at 250 tons, filled up an entire concrete building, half a block square, able to withstand attack. SAGE offered many novelties beyond just scale. Previously, computers like Colossus had produced printouts of their results. SAGE offered a visual aid, a display screen, a giant picture tube, as it was called at the time, that would show the results of the calculations in a way designed to help the operator digest the information. An operator could even interact with the screen using a light gun pen. This would all help them understand as quickly as possible what was happening in the skies and offer them their best options as to how to engage different targets based on their location, velocity, and position. They could also use the computer's memory to go back and look at how a situation had developed. By analyzing the past, Sage can project into the future, IBM explained. Aladdin's lamp couldn't do more. The system needed to help tell the difference between civilian airliners and Soviet bombers, and so would become the forerunner of modern civilian air traffic control. All this data needed to be collated from a number of sites, so information went across phone lines to the central computer using a device that became known as a modem. This was the first international computer network, although it was a closed and very specialized system, and marks the next stage in the merging of computers and communications. Strategic Air Command ran the bomber and ballistic missile force and had a sprawling system using computers for command and control, war planning, and data processing, with 900 programmers and systems analysts working on 35 machines. As the 1960s progressed, nuclear-tipped missiles designed to shoot down incoming Soviet bombers over the ocean were being controlled by computers. One or two people started to wonder if having these missiles stationed within the U.S., largely outside of human control, involved a degree of risk. What if these systems went wrong or someone interfered with them? Could a nuclear-tipped missile be sent the wrong way and back into the United States? A young, technically savvy Air Force captain called Roger Shell, who had worked on SAGE, became one of the first people to worry about computer security. He was the kind of person who annoyed senior colleagues because he actually knew what he was talking about and was willing to point out when they did not. His superiors assured him there was no risk. After all, under the two-man rule, a pair of real people needed to turn their real keys to launch a missile. They told him a study proved this. "I looked at it and I said it's garbage," Shell told his colleagues after reading the study. "You can't say that." "No, all that stuff doesn't matter because at the end of the day, the keys that you're using are not in the electrical wires. Their input is to a computer and the actual launch command is given by a computer. And the controls that are provided by a computer. There's no positive control. It doesn't matter what the human did with keys or didn't do. It's a computer that sends the signals." Shell refused to sign off on the system as secure. It was vulnerable to subversion, he maintained. "People were not particularly impressed," he recalls. "It caused a fair degree of turbulence." The 1964 film Dr. Strangelove brutally satirized the dangers of hair-trigger nuclear responses and the idea that both sides in the Cold War were increasingly escalating and automating their response to the first sign of attack by the other. In the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis, these fears felt all too real. Roger Shell was getting a reputation for being a troublemaker who asked difficult questions. But some recognized that he knew what he was talking about. He was brought on board a team who went on to produce a groundbreaking but almost forgotten 1972 report into computer security for the U.S. Air Force. It was known as the Anderson Report, after the principal author James P. Anderson, an engineer and expert who had done work for the NSA and CIA. But because the NSA was so secret, it kept its computer systems inside its walls and unconnected to the outside world, meaning it fell to the Air Force, whose systems were far more open and global, to be the first to worry about security. Anderson's report is the blueprint for every cybersecurity report today. Anderson saw that the Air Force was becoming increasingly reliant on machines that had vulnerabilities which opened them up to subversion. A central issue was how to deal with what was known as the multi-user problem. Computers were not the personal terminals of today, but huge, expensive monsters. Their processing power needed to be shared among lots of users, not least to make them economic given the vast costs. This was true both of the military and of universities, where staff had to log how much time they used a computer for so they could be charged rental. In intelligence and military institutions, this created a problem. If lots of individuals were using the same computer, how could you keep information secure when some were cleared for top secret and others were not? In the earliest days, computer security was about physical security, making sure there was a guard or that anyone who wanted to enter the processing facility had a swipe card. But with different clearance levels in an institution, it became inefficient to restrict computers on that basis. And what about the problem that now computers were being hooked up so that they could be accessed remotely from terminals? Computers were being underutilized in the Air Force, Anderson found, because of the fear that users would see something they were not supposed to. This was not just about data spillage, but also the risk of a system being open to hostile penetration from what were called malicious users. In 1972, the Defense Intelligence Agency was creating large, multi-access databases to share information. A test was run to check the security of the system. The NSA easily got inside. It even proved possible to gain access from a remote terminal and seize control of the entire system. It was a terrifying insight into what could be done. Computers were an especially tempting target since so much data was in one place if someone could get in. This went beyond the possibility of passive interception of communications like wiretapping, although this was still a worry in case someone put a monitoring device on the hardware during manufacture or maintenance. The big problem was active infiltration or subversion. Someone being able to get inside the computer and issue instructions to gather information or do certain things. They could even play with the operating system itself, the instructions for how a computer should work, and thereby subvert and bypass all the security you put in place. The fact that the operating systems were obtained off the shelf and were not developed in-house just added to the concerns. These systems had never been designed with security in mind and now were becoming hugely complex. This meant there were flaws, vulnerabilities, in all the systems, which were hard to spot and which a skilled programmer could exploit. The beauty of computers was that they could be programmed to do anything. The problem was that it was possible to manipulate these instructions in a malicious way to do something untoward. The dense complexity and increasing length of computer code as computers were asked to do more and more would make such malicious code increasingly hard to find. If everything in a computer's system is built on code, then it could always be altered by code. Someone could just reprogram the computer to give themselves top-level access, for instance. Vulnerabilities plus code equaled a problem. Trapdoors were one of the fears the Anderson report raised. Programmers sometimes put in secret ways to bypass controls and security checks to make their lives easier if they needed to change something. But what if these were introduced deliberately in a malicious act? A few keystrokes and an attacker would be in. Since commercial systems were being used, what happened if someone put in a trapdoor during the manufacturing process or when they updated or revised the software? How do you check for that? The variety of possible attacks was dizzying. The most fascinating aspect of the Anderson report is the appendix that outlines penetration techniques. Although written from the point of view of defenders, it is effectively a how-to guide for hackers. The appendix goes point by point through the myriad ways in which someone can exploit the systems and uses real examples. The Trojan horse, the report notes, is a rather interesting attack in which code with trap doors is placed into a target system. This is done by presenting the operators of a system with a program that appears to them to be so useful that they will ignore any concerns and run it on their system, even though they may not know what is inside. Like the Greek myth, it was a gift horse that contained a surprise. The Trojan horse, once accepted through the gate, might then be able to record the user ID and password of people using the system, or copy all or part of the file to make it accessible to a penetrator. This had the potential to bypass all security controls and is described as the quintessence of the malicious threat against contemporary systems. Here, four decades ago, is the realization that the most dangerous point in computer security came when the human met the technical, where an attacker might play on someone's desire to take a shortcut or utilize some clever program, but in doing so, let the enemy in. Trojan horses remain a favored method of getting inside a system today. The report said it could not emphasize enough that patching known weaknesses or vulnerabilities individually was ultimately futile. Creating firewalls to stop data spilling between users, encrypting all stored information, and carrying out surveillance and monitoring of activity on machines were all useful, but were fundamentally just papering over cracks without dealing with the fundamental problems. These are pretty much the same techniques that cybersecurity companies talk about today, often portraying them as some great innovation. And a modern security expert might allow themselves a little chuckle at the failure to make that much progress on this more than four decades on. The size and complexity of systems that were not designed with security in mind were a headache then, and a much bigger one now, as the scale has grown enormously. The great irony of computer security is that many of the flaws that allow an attacker to get in have been known for decades, many since the Anderson Report, but they have not always been fixed. Why? Because companies desperate to get products to market first in a fiercely competitive and innovative environment have never prioritized security enough to slow down and redesign their systems. It was never worth it. The Anderson Report recognized that a whole new way of conceptualizing security was required, rather than just plugging holes. It came up with the concept of a reference monitor or security kernel to verify activity on a system, but the panel could not yet see a way of implementing it, and so was left pessimistic about the central danger of subversion in the future. Among the things Anderson did was look at the relative costs of security. Finding a vulnerability to exploit was reckoned to involve a month of one person's time, costed at $2,000, and less than $1,000 of computer time, a total cost of $3,000. If you were to patch your system to close the exploit but not fundamentally change it, then you might raise the attacker's costs to $8,000, but they would still get in. The cost of redesigning and creating a fully secure system, which no one could get into, was reckoned at a sizable $10 million per system. Security did not come cheap. This is the other truth that remains today. Proper security costs, but most commercial companies, and even most parts of government apart from the most secret, are not willing to pay what it takes to be truly secure. The economics are in favor of the attacker and the spy. Anderson's report ends with a stark warning. The situation will become even more acute in the future as potential enemies recognize the attractiveness of Air Force data systems as intelligence targets and perceive how little is needed to subvert them. As you read the report, you sense that while doing the research, an awful truth had dawned on James Anderson, Roger Shell, and the others involved, which they were now desperate to try to communicate urgently to everyone they could. The truth was that computers were not secure. They had not been built for security, and it was not easy to engineer or retrofit them to be secure. Security should have been there from the start, but it was not. When the report was being finished, the team behind it began to debate what to do about what they had found. Should it be published? Should it be classified? The NSA representatives had concerns, perhaps worrying it would alert attackers to what could be done. Those with links to industry wanted the information out there so people could understand the dangers and improve their defenses. So another early truth about computer security was exposed. The tension between keeping secret the vulnerabilities you found so that others could not exploit them, and perhaps your own spies could, and making them public so people could improve their systems. Roger Shell, who was project managing the report, wanted to publish it openly and printed between 300 and 500 copies and simply sent them out. The next day he got a phone call. NSA has determined that this is classified and they're exercising their classification authority, Shell recalled being told by the official. I said, good luck, it's mailed. Shell also participated in what were called Tiger Teams in the late 1960s and 1970s, groups of people carrying out penetration testing to find the flaws in systems used in the defense and intelligence community. They were never popular with people who thought their systems were watertight. In-house at the NSA, they knew all the dangers of Trojan horses and operating system vulnerabilities, but commercial companies were going round claiming their machines were safe. This was becoming a selling point since companies like Ford and General Motors were starting to think about the need to protect corporate secrets like technical data and intellectual property. As a penetration team, we demonstrated that that wasn't true, that we could get to, essentially, things that they didn't think anybody could get to, which didn't endear us particularly. Honeywell Systems had taken out full-page adverts boasting of their security. Shell orchestrated a meeting with a senior vice president of the company and its technical team on one side and Shell's team on the other. Shell got one of the overconfident technical staffers from Honeywell to change his password to something new and then had one of his team tap at a keyboard. A few seconds later, Shell's man printed out the new password and handed it to the corporate bigwig to show how easy it was, a trick still used to scare executives. At the same time, IBM was showing off that it had a $40 million budget for security. At a conference, Shell piped up, "From what I can see, the IBM budget allocation of the $40 million is roughly $39 million for marketing and $1 million for travel." That did not go down very well. What was clear was that none of the companies wanted to change the fundamentals of their systems. They just wanted to patch up the holes they could find to stop the ship sinking, not build an expensive new boat. Companies, right up to today, prefer to get their products out first before a competitor and then patch any security later, rather than spend time working out how to secure them from first principles and risk losing out in the market. The pace of private sector innovation behind the rise of computers had many advantages, but also a distinct disadvantage when it came to the priority given to computers. The Anderson Report had come at the cusp of a new era for computers. Computers were beginning to talk to each other rather than sitting like kings in splendid isolation on their thrones. This led the report to highlight fears of a man in the middle who might be able to interfere with the lines between Pentagon machines, requiring security to be end-to-end. But at the same time as the Anderson Report was issued, a new type of networking was emerging in the outside world that was going to take on a life of its own and revolutionize computers. It would become known as the Internet. There are plenty of myths about the creation of the Internet, including the idea that it was a creature of the Pentagon. The real story is more complex. Part of the problem is the occasional confusion as to what is being talked about. There is a series of concepts, ranging from packet switching to computer networks talking to each other through the World Wide Web, all of which are distinct but which tend to get wrongly lumped together as the Internet. Innovation is often a collaborative process, but there is also the problem that success has a thousand fathers, with many individuals laying claim to their critical role. In simplest terms, the Internet is the ability of computer networks to communicate and connect with each other. The Cold War fear of nuclear Armageddon did play a role in some of the initial thinking. Paul Baron, a Polish-born engineer who worked on early computers, joined RAND, the U.S. Air Force's outsourced research arm, in 1959. He saw there was a glaring weak spot in the way in which military command and control depended on shortwave radio and a national telephone system run by AT&T. Tests in the Pacific showed that a high-altitude nuclear bomb blast would disrupt shortwave radio for many hours, while RAND computer simulations showed that the telephone system within the U.S. would collapse after an attack. In order for the concept of mutually assured destruction to hold, there needed to be the guarantee that retaliation could be launched. This required a command and control communication system that would survive even a surprise attack so the president could issue his order to retaliate. With nuclear apocalypse only narrowly avoided in the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, Paul Baron began to look at what kind of communications networks might be more likely to survive. The obvious answer was one that was decentralized, without a single center that could be knocked out. But then there was a further idea. What about not just a decentralized, but a distributed communications network, meaning that there was no hierarchy at all and therefore no single point of vulnerability? A distributed network was like a web, with all the different parts connected to each other rather than being connected into one or two single central points. This offered the possibility of redundancy so that even if one or two connections were destroyed by an attack, a message could take a different path. Baron says he realized that the best way of doing this would be by breaking up radio communications into the digital form of ones and zeros, so that audio quality would not degrade on a long route. This could then be sent by breaking down a message into smaller fragments and by sending the routing information, the to and from, with each of these blocks. One colleague suggested the analogy of a postman at each node of the network who would receive a letter with to and from details so he knew where to send it on to or back from if it got stuck. Also attached would be the route the message had already taken, which over time would help him establish the quickest route to send future messages. Another analogy was the hot potato. Each bit of a message was a hot potato, tossed from person to person, with the aim of getting it out of your hands as soon as possible before you got burnt. If the first person you wanted to toss it to had their hands full already, you would look for the next nearest person until you found someone who could receive it. If everyone was busy, then you would throw it back to the person who gave it to you and ask them to find another route. An algorithm could work out the best available route based on the experience of the system so far. The aim was to move the data round the network fast until it found its destination. Since it was broken into chunks, parts of the message might arrive by different routes and out of sequence, so a serial number in the header would allow the original message to be reconstructed. Baron's concepts proved prophetic, but were not quite adopted in the way he envisaged and were not yet married up to computer networking. Britain had its own candidate for developing some of the underlying concepts for the Internet, although again it missed out on the credit. The National Physical Laboratory at Teddington was home to a scientist called Donald Davis. Colleagues remember Davis as a quiet, self-assured figure whose large head seemed designed to contain an unusually large brain. Every year he would study something completely different from his normal work, like contemporary art, to keep him stimulated. He had begun his career during the war, working with Klaus Fuchs, later found to be a Soviet spy, and then worked on the early ACE, automatic computing engine, computer that Turing had been involved in. To use ACE, a researcher had to book time slots or give their instructions to computer operators. The next step was to lay cables between the computers to other buildings on the site where users worked. Davis looked for another solution to make this sharing of computing power easier. Telephone switching had long fascinated Davis, the kind of work Tommy Flowers had undertaken years before, and Davis often visited the post office research team at Dollis Hill. But connecting up computers along phone lines was proving a wasteful business. A phone line used a single circuit or connection from origin to destination, and that line would be monopolized even if the data were only flowing a small proportion of the time and at irregular intervals, perhaps only using 1% of the capacity. In 1965, Davis came up with the idea of breaking data into small chunks and then storing it. When a line was free, it could be forwarded in an efficient burst with other messages before being reconstituted at the destination based on the to-and-fro headers linked to the message. Davis gave the concept its formal name, packet switching, and in 1966 wrote a paper called Proposal for a Digital Communication Network. Colleagues say Davis had foreseen packet switching as the backbone of a very large global communications network, delivering sound, video, even, he said, railway timetables. At least one copy of the paper went over to the US and the Pentagon, where it was read by Larry Roberts. The two men met at a conference in the US in 1967, where Davis talked about his ideas. Davis was sure his paper had an impact. When I visited him in the Pentagon on one occasion, it was lying on his desk in tatters, Davis later recalled. It had obviously been very heavily thumbed and turned over. Roberts, then at MIT, was also looking at ways of connecting up computers to share their workload and wrote his own seminal 1966 paper called Toward a Cooperative Network of Time-Sharing Computers. Davis began experimenting with how to actually send messages. He briefed the Minister for Technology, Tony Benn, and the Postmaster General, John Stonehouse, another of those communist spies. In January 1970, the Mark I network first operated successfully, and it went live in July 1971. By then, though, it had conceded pole position. Larry Roberts's larger, more ambitious U.S. project had forged ahead. The idea for something like the Internet was in the air at the time, but the Americans moved faster and built bigger. Roberts's project had been backed by and named after the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, part of the U.S. Department of Defense, and so was called ARPANET. Davis was always clear that ARPANET had made more progress, but could not hide just the touch of regret given that he felt his paper may have had a role and that it had been largely overlooked. In October 1969, a UCLA computer science professor sent a message from UCLA to the Stanford Research Institute through ARPANET. The first attempt crashed. The second worked. Two different computers had begun a tentative, awkward conversation, the beginnings of the vast cacophony of global noise that the Internet has today become. In late 1970, the man in charge of ARPANET suggested to Britain's Davis that they get their two networks to talk to each other. Bizarrely, this was scuppered by politics in London. The Heath government was keen to build links with Europe rather than the US. As a result, the NPL, which came under the Department of Technology, was instructed to work on projects with Europe, not America. So instead, the task fell to academics at University College London, UCL. After funding crises and tangles with British bureaucracy, in September 1973, ARPANET reached out over the Atlantic and the two sides were able to converse in real time. That was not what the system had really been built for. Sharing computing power was the original intent, but, as was often the case with technology, people used it for what they enjoyed doing or found useful, and that increasingly became person-to-person communication. In 1972, Ray Tomlinson started to use the at symbol to show a message was from a particular person at a particular computer network. In 1976, the Queen visited Malvern and became the first head of state to send an email, with the username HME2, standing for Her Majesty Elizabeth II. So by the early 1970s, different systems from different universities and even different countries began to connect up with each other. Modems were converting digital data into sounds, which could then be transmitted along a phone line and reassembled. Networks were talking to each other, a network of networks. The inter-network traffic was then abbreviated down to Internet. The definitive article at the front tended to come later. A protocol was needed for these different networks to be able to understand each other. This led to work by a group in California including Vince Cerf, Bob Kahn, Bob Braden, and John Postel, creating a common standard known as TCP/IP. At the end of the 1980s, a mild-mannered British scientist, Tim Berners-Lee, was working at the CERN laboratory in Switzerland. He was interested in how to organize information so that the large community of researchers could keep track of each other's work and draw connections between different projects. He developed the idea of a web in which information held on servers could be pulled off using a browser which navigated the growing stack of information. Again, this idea proved, to the surprise of purists, to be useful in realms far beyond pure physics research. It was christened the World Wide Web. Once it became clearer that it was getting easier for ordinary people to navigate the Internet, the private sector began to move in on a world previously the domain of academics and researchers. The origins of the Internet are vital to an understanding of how it shaped spying. Its defining features were the key to its success, but they also engineered a form of insecurity that laid it open to espionage. The network is dumb, and it has no central control or security. It is simply a mechanism for sending data packets from one place to another as fast as possible. It does not care who sends them or what they contain. There is no guarantee what route a packet takes. No guarantee that it will arrive in one piece in a timely fashion or without being copied or interfered with. There is no guarantee that it is from the address or person it is supposed to be from. This meant it was incredibly open and adaptable. People would eventually be able to send different types of data, like audio and video, and design their own applications and systems to sit on the Internet and send that data. There was no authority restricting or defining how it would be used. This would fuel tremendous innovation, but also make it susceptible to all kinds of mischief. These attributes provided speed and flexibility, but also allowed people to do things like pretend to be somebody else, divert traffic, and implant malicious code. The Internet would be used to do things the original creators never dreamt of, and that would include spying. The openness of the Internet structure is partly because of Paul Barron's concept of survivability, but later because it was built by a small academic community who wanted to share information, a trusted community in which people often knew each other personally. And so it was not designed with security in mind. And because the Internet was not the creature of government or commerce, but academic research and cooperation, those values infused the system. There was also an element of the late 1960s California counterculture to the whole project, a focus on freedom and sharing, which might have been very different if the government had planned the whole thing from the outset, or if companies had been in charge. This mindset would go on to infuse the tech sector as it grew, with companies and the state trying to wrestle back influence at various points. As more and more people took to the Internet, the openness ensured its spread. Security features like verifying the route a message took or the identity of the person sending it would have slowed the whole project down, added to the cost, and been contrary to the cooperative mindset. But the weaknesses could be exploited as the Internet organically expanded. No one predicted that what was designed at Stanford and Teddington would so rapidly scale up into the world-dominating system on which business, government, and individuals increasingly conducted their work and went about their lives. But the speed of its rise meant that inherent weaknesses were embedded in a system which quickly became too large and too essential to roll back and redesign, or to junk and start again, although some still talk of this today. It was just not possible to retrofit security. There is always a balance between openness, speed, and innovation on the one side, and security on the other. A more secure internet may not have taken off in the same way, but no one even tried. And it was not long before some of the weaknesses were exposed. The first to exploit this inherent insecurity were not the spies, but pranksters and explorers within the community itself. In May 1962, a group of young people clustered in a room at MIT's Science Open House. It was one of the regular occasions when students got to show off what they had been working on. A screen was perched high on a cabinet so that as many people as possible could watch what it was showing. The previous year, a small group of young men at the university had realized you could do something a little more fun than intended with the cathode ray tube display on which Sage and those big gray computers had shown the flight paths of Soviet bombers as bright dots against a dark screen, and which had in part been designed at MIT. You could program the computer to move the lights around the dark screen like a bouncing ball. It seemed that you could program computers to do all kinds of things if you knew what you were doing, and the students had next created a game called Space War. Now, in May 1962, they were making their spaceships fire off torpedoes in battle against a simulation of the night sky. Those involved in modifying code to do new things and showing off to their friends called themselves hackers. MIT was where hacking emerged in its original sense, a playful rather than illegal activity. It was all about demonstrating what you could do, reveling in the power, beauty, and simplicity of computer code. But as the years went by, a more anti-authoritarian and mischievous part of the culture would come to the fore, in which people wanted to demonstrate how they could find vulnerabilities in computers and get into places where they were not supposed to be. It was all about the challenge. The more the people running the systems tried to stop people doing mischievous things, the more these hackers wanted to prove they were better and could get in. Through most of the 1960s, this was fun and games for the students at MIT, perhaps at most trying to get round the time limit on how long you could use a machine or the rental charges. But as computers were connected up to the outside world over phone lines, people outside this community realized they could dial into MIT's computers and display their skills. That would include deliberately crashing the system. That annoyed the hell out of the MIT students and staff, who would lose their work. So the people at MIT at the time that were responsible for these computer systems, they were hackers themselves, they said, "What's the best way to do this?" recalls Herb Lin, a student at the time who dabbled in hacking. You'd think they would put in big computer security systems, passwords and firewalls. Instead, they changed the system to implement a command called crash and said in a list of system instructions what it did. The note said, if you execute this command, crash, you will crash the system, and everybody will lose their work and be really mad at you. Don't do it. The result was that no one bothered any more to crash the system. The point was that it had all been about the challenge of showing your peers that you were clever enough to do it. But once it became possible to cause a crash by just entering a command, then you were not showing off to anyone anymore. For Lynn, it was an example of the psychology of hacking and how human rather than technical responses were sometimes the solution. The more connected a computer becomes, the more powerful it may prove to be for the user, but also the more vulnerable. Connections with other computers immediately introduce an element of risk. This was clear from the start, but became increasingly clear as computers and communications merged over the coming decades. I can design for you a perfectly secure computer, but you would look at it and call it a brick, says Herb Lin. It is a useless computer. It doesn't take any information in or take any information out, but it is perfectly secure. What you really want is a functional computer that is secure. The problem is that you have to put information into it to make it useful. If I can fool you into putting bad information into it, then I win the game. The more useful a computer is, by being easy for it to talk to other computers and trusting them when it does, rather than demanding complicated security checks, the more vulnerable it is. And the human factor remains the key. One of the key differences between humans and computers is trust. Connecting with another person, whether socially, professionally, or intimately, can be richly rewarding, but also dangerous, so people have learned to make judgments on whom to trust. These are subtle and learnt by individuals and societies. Computers are not so good at such judgments when they are asked to connect with other computers. They can be given rules, do not connect with another computer coming from this location, or which is bearing this piece of code. But those rules can easily be subverted by a clever person at the other end. Computers lack the ability to make the kinds of judgments which humans can. Put simply, machines are not so good at telling the good guy from the bad guy when the bad guy can disguise himself. Deception is what all the threats to cybersecurity are built on, argues Lin. Technology can help you make judgments about what is safe, but since a clever human is normally behind the bad code that is being sent over the internet, it takes a very human understanding to spot it and defeat it. Hackers might be tricksters, but could they also be spies? What opportunities might all these vulnerabilities offer them? Again, Roger Schell was one of the first to wonder about just that. It was 1979, and a KGB officer was addressing a select group of Soviet officials with not just secrecy, but an added sense of excitement. Comrades, he began, I will brief you about the most significant breakthrough in intelligence collection since the breaking of the unbreakable Japanese and German ciphers in World War II. This breakthrough was, he explained, the penetration of the security of American computers. Schell imagined the KGB man then explaining that there was virtually no major American national defense secret that was not stored on a computer somewhere. And almost all of those computers were accessible, at least in theory, to the KGB's prying eyes. What was so wonderful, he said, was that it was no longer the case that they needed to wait for information to be communicated so that it could be intercepted in transit and decoded, as Bletchley had been forced to do. Instead, the data was at rest rather than in motion, just sitting there, waiting to be accessed. All this could be done, he said, with virtually no risk to our agents. Schell was just imagining the scene when he wrote an article. He was trying to make a point that computer security was the Achilles heel of an electronic air force. Technology, he explained, had always been a mixed blessing, bringing opportunity but with it, vulnerability. Everyone could see the opportunities, but he had seen enough of the dark side of the penetration of computer systems to know about the dangers. What was different about computers, Shell understood even more clearly in 1979 than when he had first thought about the problem as a young captain in the 1960s, was that they offered the chance to do much more than intercept data and gather intelligence. If you could get into a system, you could actually change and modify the code. In other words, you could make computers do things they were not supposed to do. Fire a missile the wrong way, switch off a radar defense system. This was more than just traditional espionage. It was raising the possibility of sabotage and subversion. Funding for Shell's proposed solution had just been cut, which made his anger all the more clear. Higher-ups seemed worried about cost or pointed to the fact that no enemy had actually yet been found inside a system carrying out espionage. Shell's warning was stark. If America did not appreciate these dangers, then it would be like Germany or Japan in the Second World War, complacently thinking its machines, then Enigma, now computers, were safe, when in fact the enemy was already in. The vast, heavily fortified complex buried within Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado had been studied by the Anderson Committee back in 1972, and was the place where fears of the consequences of computer security first took root in both government and public consciousness. It was home to NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command. Data from sensors located all over the world flowed into NORAD to look for missile launches and other signs of attack. Even in 1972, NORAD had what was described as a highly sophisticated wall-size display system with 12 by 16 foot screens showing what was going on and 15 individual consoles for the staff working at the command post. It was noted by Anderson that there might be some excess computer time available, which may be available to devote to wargaming and other top-secret activities. There would also be two remote terminals in secure areas that would be connected into Cheyenne. The terminals were secure, but the incoming communications lines, in some cases, were not secure, it was noted, and there were plans to connect more systems together. Hollywood took the twin fears of nuclear Armageddon and the power of computers and merged them with concern over teenage rebelliousness in the 1983 film War Games. In this hugely popular and influential movie, a young hacker nearly starts off thermonuclear war by getting inside the NORAD systems and playing what he thinks is a game without realizing his simulation is being played out for real. The film had an impact on President Reagan, who began asking questions about what might be possible. The media, fascinated by this new creature, the hacker, started to seek them out. A group of 16 to 20-year-olds called 414, after the Milwaukee area code, managed to break into supposedly secure systems like Los Alamos Lab. That led to an FBI investigation and one of the group appearing on the cover of Newsweek magazine. These rebellious teenagers were attracting an oddly glamorous mystique. People started raising questions about how fictional the Hollywood scenario really was. Amid public concern, six bills about securing computer crime were introduced into the U.S. House of Representatives in the aftermath, and in 1984, a top-secret National Security Decision Directive was signed to improve the security of sensitive systems. Over the next few years, there was a major debate as to how far the NSA should be involved in protecting government information. There were many in Congress who disliked a foreign intelligence branch of the military taking on a domestic role, and eventually it was settled that it would only protect military networks and other national security data, but not the rest of government. Already at issue was a central question: What did it mean to defend a country in this strange world of computer networks, which seemed to exist in a different space? Amid all the concern after war games, a real-life general was interviewed on ABC TV. He tried to reassure people that computers could not start a war. Man is in the loop, he said. Man makes decisions. At NORAD, computers don't make decisions. But the war games scenario was not entirely fantasy. It was, at least in part, based on real events. On the morning of the 9th of November 1979, the Honeywell computers inside Cheyenne Mountain flashed a signal. The operational duty officers at NORAD were watching their worst fears come true. Soviet missiles had been launched off the west coast by Soviet submarines. More missiles appeared on those vast screens, this time coming from the Soviet Union itself. What looked like a wave of destruction was about to descend on the U.S. Bomber crews were scrambled and missile crews told to ready for launch. For precisely 6 terrifying minutes, it looked like the Third World War was underway. The National Security Advisor was woken to be told the end was nigh. But senior officers knew there was something strange about it. A surprise attack at a time of no real tension. When they contacted the radar stations that had been providing the data on which the computers worked, those stations relayed back that they had not seen any missile launches. It quickly became clear that this was not real. It was fortunate the systems were not totally automated. People had to exercise their judgment, and they had separate communications channels to the source of the data. It turned out that a technician had fed an incorrect tape containing a training exercise into NORAD's computers. A false alarm, but also a warning.